Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is May 4th, 2020, and my guest today is economist and author Rebecca Henderson. She is the John and Natty MacArthur University Professor at Harvard University and teaches in the Harvard Business School. Her latest book and our topic for today is Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire. Rebecca, welcome to Econ Talk.
Ross, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to alert people listening at home. We are recording this in the middle of the COVID-19 experience, which could affect our audio quality a bit. We're not able to use some of our usual equipment, and broadband is a little iffier in a house with four people at home unexpectedly, often using internet during the day. And we may or may not talk about COVID-19. There's plenty to talk about in the book outside that. So we'll see how this goes. Rebecca, your book asks us to reimagine capitalism. What's wrong with the way that capitalism is now, and what problems do you hope to fix?
Let me begin by saying I'm a huge fan of capitalism. I think it's one of the greatest inventions of the human race. But I think in our current incarnation, we've allowed it to become unbalanced. I see three problems. First, accelerating inequality. A very significant fraction of the productivity gains from our booming economy over the last 20 years went to those at the very top of the distribution. Second, we are singularly failing to deal with the major environmental risks we face, particularly the risk of climate change. And third, and perhaps most important, we have systematically run down our government capacity. Government's become a dirty word. And I think the costs of that happening were visible before the pandemic in our very polarized and ineffective politics, and are very visible during the pandemic, when the costs of not having a fully functional government have become very visible.
One thing I liked about the way you opened the book with those three problems is it forced me to think about what my list would look like. I'm going to mention my three, and you can
tell me if you think
they're problems, or and if you think they belong in your top 10. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but
sure, that's so cool. Please.
So I thought, you know, what are the three biggest problems in America, at least? Maybe, you know, in the world's an even tougher question, but in America. My three would have been the people who are left behind in our economic system, which is related to your concern about inequality. But I feel very strongly that the focus on inequality, first, I think the data mistake how many people are being left behind. I think it's grossly overestimated the problem, but it's still significant. I think there's a way too large fraction of our population, especially young people, who struggle to get a foot on that ladder of economic growth. So we semi-agree there. My second issue would be at what I would call the epidemic of loneliness. It's not unrelated to the first one. Some people are not integrating into the workforce, but certainly family life is very different than it was. And we're in the middle of an experiment that may or may not turn out to be so bad, but it doesn't seem so great right now. We have a large, very high suicide rate among teens, which is deeply disturbing. So that would be my number two, which I would, you know, it's a cultural problem, but it's related to some economic problems. And the third, I would argue, is the control of information, which is bouncing back and forth between government and large tech companies, and how we handle that, I think, is, it's not a crisis right now, but I think going into the future, it's a big issue. So we overlap, at least. I think we totally agree on this issue of people being left behind. Is that true?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I care so much about inequality is it's not so much inequality per se. It's the fall in social mobility, the really tough times that people at the very bottom of the distribution are having, and the failure of opportunity that that implies. I mean, that's what really troubles me. We can talk more about the political effects of having some very, very, very rich people, which also troubles me.
Yeah, well,
I'm with you. I mean, I'm out here in rural New Hampshire, and I know people that it's not that it's not a level playing field. They're not even on the field.
Yeah, the education system has failed them, which we, I think, also agree on based on what you say in your book.
Absolutely agree. It's the epidemic of loneliness is super interesting. I do think we have a major cultural problem. I tend to sometimes frame it as we built a culture and a system which is all about me right now. And 2,000 years of human history and much of philosophy and all our major faith traditions say that's a serious mistake. And so part of what I'm trying to do with this book is open up a conversation about what it would mean to be focusing on us and later. So that's related to your second problem.
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase it. I mean, I think about it as a little bit differently, but it's the same issue. It's the death of the family, the so-called nuclear family, and the death of religion for large swaths of the population has left a gap, a hole that our culture will, I assume, fill. Either there'll be a swing back to those things or something else will come to emerge that will help people deal with that loss. But right now, I'd say we're in a transition of complicated impact.
Have you read Angus Deaton's and Anne Case's book, Deaths of Despair?
I've read a chunk of it. They were scheduled to be on the program, and I've talked to Angus about the work that underlies that book before on the program. But yeah, they'll be back. And I've looked at the book. Well, that's another topic.
Okay. I'm just saying that some of the data in that book is truly sobering.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's the left behind part. It's a combination of cultural, I think, failure is not necessarily the right word. I call it a challenge. Cultural challenges in a time of change brought on partly by technology, partly all kinds of phenomena going on
all
in the world.
All kinds of factors, yeah.
And we agree on the failings of government. One of the things I thought I'd give it an asterisk, I'd pick 3A as one of my, or maybe my fourth problem, is the rise of populism around the world and what that, where that's leading. And I think it's... That's an interesting challenge. And you and I have a different take on what's wrong with government. We'll come to that, I hope, toward the end of the conversation. But let's talk about the capitalism part. You're very concerned about the emphasis on shareholder value in the modern capitalist state, like the United States. What's wrong with that? Tell us what's wrong with that and what we should be doing differently.
I'm super concerned about the unilateral focus on shareholder value maximization at any cost, which is slightly different from not liking shareholder value maximization. I'm on the board of two public companies. One of them's a Fortune 200, and I'm a card-carrying member of the Neoclassical Guild. I think returning profits to shareholders is central and a major function of the corporation. But I have two worries. One is time frame, and we can talk about whether the system is too short or too long-term focused. But I, for example, believe there are a number of opportunities that many firms should be pursuing that would be NPV positive over the long term, but they're having difficulty pursuing.
Net present value.
I'm sorry, pursuing their present value at any cost. And so I believe there are a number of long-term opportunities that would generate very healthy returns for investors, but for a variety of reasons, they're not pursuing them. And one of those reasons is a misapprehension that is, no, I have to do shareholder value at any cost right now. The second problem is that is almost as it were a contradiction in terms. I'm worried about firms that maximize shareholder value by changing the rules of the game. One of the most effective ways to make money, after all, is to go to a local legislature and build yourself a cozy little monopoly. In the book, I talk about Disney's extension of the Copyright Act as an example of this, a move that really, it's incredible to believe it created any kind of social value at all, but dropped several billion dollars to Disney's bottom line, money taken from the pockets of their customers, but no real value created. It's just a rule change. That's what makes me nervous. When we say to a manager, your duty is to maximize shareholder value, period, and not your duty is to maximize shareholder value in the service of a genuinely free and fair capitalism, which is supported by a complex network of rules and ethical custom, and one of your duties is not to subvert those rules. That's what bothers me.
Yeah, obviously it bothers me too. As listeners know, it's often called crony capitalism. It's the temptation, as you say, to use the rules of the game to enhance your competitive situation. The phrase that you used after that was more complicated than one might hope for, though. When you said, instead of maximizing shareholder at any value, at any cost, you should maximize shareholder value subject to, and then there was a long set of interesting, lovely ideals. How does an actual CEO deal with that?
So, forgive me. What I would say more colloquially is, instead of only maximizing shareholder value, you have a duty to the health of the institutions that support free and fair markets, and to the health of the society on which you rely.
So how would you advise, and I know you've advised some, how would you advise a CEO who is uncertain about that trade-off? Right, that there's a trade-off there. You're suggesting that when you have more than one goal, and of course, you and I both agree that I wish there were a norm today that said, "Don't use the political system to exploit other people." Right. I wish that were in play for both legislators and lobbyists and corporations, but that isn't there. But okay, but now let's say the larger set of challenges that a corporation might face, that it's product might contribute to global warming, that it has certainly could pay more higher wages than the market wage. How do I navigate that as a CEO? How do I deal with the trade-offs between shareholder value, which is pretty clear, it also has its own ambiguity, but pretty clear, versus these other social goals that you want them to follow?
What I tell them is you can still use the same metric, that what we're trying to maximize is long-term prosperity and freedom. And so it's not a matter of trading off profits now for some intangible good. It's a matter of changing off profits now for profits later. At the extreme, at the general level, if we think for a moment, and I don't know if you'll like this, but let's for a moment assume that you and I are the only two business people in the world and we control everything, but we're not monopolists. We have lots of little competition going on. But suppose that we had decision rights over the whole of business.
Okay.
I think we would decide to invest heavily in mitigating the problem of global warming, in trying to slow it down. That we would see that that's an enormous potential risk to our business and to the stability of the whole system. And we'd say, you know, that's worth coughing up 2 or 3% of GDP to head off. And so it is a trade-off, but it's a time-based trade-off. Now, you're going to say to me, but wait, your average CEO is worried about the free riding problem, right? I'm going to go to them and I'm going to say, Mary, I want you to invest now because the good of the system in the long term, blah, blah, blah. And she's going to look at me and say, well, that's very nice, Rebecca, but right now I have a business to run and investors to serve. And, you know, I could make the investment, but unless everybody else makes the investment, we all still go down together. So to the individual CEO, I say two things. The first is, you need to be aware of the larger problem. And we can come back to this about how business might come to act collectively to really focus on these broader goals with mass which suffer from massive free rider problem. But, you know, how do we think about a collective movement to create that public good we all need? At a local level, I say, Mary, well, do what you can. Lots of research suggests that there are billion-dollar opportunities in thinking carefully about your environmental footprint, depending on the business you're in. Lots of research suggests that if you treat your people better, if you adopt what I call a high road employment model, for many businesses, you'll see productivity and creativity and innovation increase. Lots of evidence to think that while consumers won't pay more for so-called sustainable products, you can see share gains if consumers really believe you're doing the right thing. Lots of evidence that your investors are starting to worry about these big problems and that they may have gotten themselves together to solve the collective action problem. And they're going to come to you and say, what are you doing about climate? What are you doing about your people? You need to get ready for that. So I'm a very pragmatic person, Russ. It's not like, well, throw everything out the window. We have a new way of being. It's more like we need to make progress against these problems. What can we do right here, right now? And how might that add up to something like, you and I would both love this, a norm against using your power to buy the political process for your own gain?
You know, I hate to disappoint you on the climate change thing, and it's an issue that passionate listeners on both sides of this issue. So I want to try to say this in a way that doesn't have anyone stop putting down their phone. I would suggest that while you and I are both concerned about it, your concern is stronger than mine. I'm more optimistic about the ability of humans to adapt to climate change. I'm uncertain about the scope of it. And we might want to live in a world where you and I are in charge, where we give that problem to the political process, which is about compromise. That political process is about – the political process recognizes that we have different goals. Some of us have different costs and benefits from various policies. Some of us have uncertainty about what the actual outcomes are going to be. And the political process is supposed to adjudicate those uncertainties and compromise, because it can't deal with unanimity 99% of the time. There's always going to be disagreement. And that's how the political system is designed to work. It's designed to deal with that non-unanimity. But if you're telling me that as CEOs, we should decide, or as designers of the rules for CEOs, that we should decide a level of expertise that none of us have, almost none of us, about how serious the problem is, what are the options for mitigation versus adaptation. I think we're in a very uncertain world of, again, how to behave. That's all I would suggest there, that you know, the implications of that, I would say it a little bit more strongly. If you task, I can't believe I'm using task as a verb. I think it's the first time in my life. If you task CEOs with the job of making the world a better place through public policy, rather than using the political process for that, you've opened a Pandora's box, because there's going to be a lot of things that CEOs want to do that you and I might think are awful, but I don't want them to do that using other people's money. So for me, the value of the shareholder maximization without fraud, of course, without cronyism, the value of that model is it lets those problems be solved by the political process and gives business leaders a metric that they can actually use and that they have skin in the game in, which they don't really in that public policy game. So I'm worried about pandering. I'm worried about self-righteous decisions by CEOs, again, using other people's money. That doesn't seem like the right feedback loops are going to be there either. What are your thoughts?
Russ, you've opened up at least two enormous questions. So let me just touch on the first and see if we can bracket it for the moment, which is I completely agree with you that the best way to address climate change is through the political process. And I completely agree with you that the thought of CEOs making policy for the world makes me all jumpy. And I also completely agree with you that good people can disagree about climate change and how fast we move against it and what kinds of trade-offs we make over time. Completely there with you on all three of those points. So let's see if I can sort of back into where the points of disagreement lie.
And see if you can budge me a little bit. pull me in your direction. See what you can do.
To make you think this is intriguing. I'm not going for budge. I'm going for intrigue you. So here's the issue. Two things. First, I do think that if I were maximizing shareholder value for the world, I would personally invest my own resources to head off climate change now, which is the point I was trying to make when I said if just you and I were CEOs for the world. So that's a point about, you know, trade-offs. I think, and I've met a bunch of investors who think this, that they want to make those investments now because they're worried about the risk. Again, for me, always the argument about climate change is how much do you want to bet against these long tail, potentially really unpleasant risks? Yep. So we could have that climate change conversation. But let's come back to the how much do we want CEOs in business? Because you're pointing to a central weirdness of my book, which is I suggest that CEOs should lobby like crazy to make it really hard for them to lobby. The single ask from my book, you know, when people say, what are the three things you want? I say, I want CEOs to lobby to get money out of politics. I want a genuine political process, which is really adjudicating these issues. One of the reasons I believe that we're making so little progress against climate change is precisely because our political process around these issues is mucked up with hundreds of millions of dollars invested by fossil fuel companies that stand to lose if we enact any kind of climate legislation. And so we don't have a genuine political process. So I'm trying to tell business, like, this is really a bad idea. We've got to get business out of politics, and you should use your power to do that, which I fully understand is a little strange. But well, I'm desperate.
Well, on the flip side of that, you'd have to concede, I think, that the profit motive, pure profit, just shareholder value equivalent in all its dimensions, gave us the fracking revolution, which has reduced the amount of carbon put in the air because the natural gas that's been discovered is cleaner than the oil and coal. And it hasn't given us, but it's tried to give us a nuclear power revolution that would have done an enormous amount to reduce climate change. That profit opportunity isn't there because of policy in response to politics. And, you know, I could argue, I would like to, that we should push to have more nuclear power in the United States because our political system has irrationally responded to that and taken out the profit opportunity that should be there.
So two things. First, I am so with you on the profit motive. You know, as I've been talking about reimagining capitalism to a wide variety of audiences, I run into people all the time that say, why reimagine it? Why don't we just throw it out the window? And I say, no, you really don't want to do that. Trust me, you really don't want to do that. There's no way we're going to solve the problems we face without harnessing the profit motive full on. So I am so with you. And of course, as you would guess, that's one of the reasons I'm really in favor of some kind of price on fossil fuel emissions, because I think it would just really give the private sector this huge boost. But on the nuclear point, I was an MIT professor for 20 years. I love nuclear power. Yes, please. If it were me, I'd be building a nuclear plant a week. And I agree, the politics of that are super tricky. We could talk about people overvalue risks of a certain type.
Yeah.
And undervalue others. And, you know, if it were me, I'd be running massive campaigns on, you know, why no, it has to be nuclear and that has to be a part of the solution and don't worry. And I would do all the things I suspect you'd want me to do.
Do you tell your students that?
I'm sorry?
Do you tell your students that urge?
Oh, yes.
And yes. What's their reaction?
Anytime anyone asks me about nuclear power, I give you this answer. On this, I'm completely consistent. If you were to watch the online version of Reimagining Capitalism, which is called Sustainable Business Strategy.
And we'll link to it.
Thank you. I highlight an MIT-funded startup, which is all about building a next-generation nuclear plant, which burns its own waste, which has passive safety. No, I'm completely consistent on this. To be fair, I very rarely get pushback.
Interesting.
You know, it's interesting. I think at least, you know, in my own little world, but I talk to a lot of environmentalists. I talk to a lot of people who care about climate. I don't get pushback on this. I think it's clear that we need as many solutions as we can get.
So let's move on to labor practices, which take up a chunk of the book and I think are really interesting and challenging both in the United States and outside the United States. I want to take an example used in the book. Because for me, again, it highlights some of the challenges of what might be called a more compassionate perspective as opposed to, say, maximizing shareholder value, but that I think it's not as straightforward. So you talk about the example of Nike, the athletic shoe company headed by Phil Knight. And Nike gets singled out you mentioned an article in Harper's, the magazine in 1992, where an activist reveals that workers in Nike's factories make very little money. A particular worker is highlighted as making $1.03 a day, 14 cents an hour roughly, and that the labor cost of the $80 pair of Nike shoes is 12 cents, and that this is unconscionable. And it ends with a dramatic statement about how free market advocates should be not so happy with this. So let's talk about that. Nike, talk about how Nike responded to that and whether you thought that was the right thing to do or not.
And can I begin by saying that what you quoted is not my belief? That's what the media threw.
Correct.
At Nike.
Absolutely. And that was one of many. There were many.
So yeah. Nike had a massive brand problem. And it was a real brand problem. So forgive me, I've lost track of your question.
So the question is, what should Nike do in the face of this? They had a brand problem. They could have responded in a variety of ways. How did they respond? And do you use it in the book as an exemplar of how firms should deal with the fact that many workers are underpaid by Western standards?
Yes. So it's really interesting. You're focusing on pay. And I think what Nike focused on was the fact that it was a 12 or 14-year-old boy.
Oh, that too. Yeah, go ahead.
And that many of the workers, they discovered that many of the workers they were using were effectively child slaves, that they'd been sold by their parents. There's a legal form for it. But that was what they thought the brand vulnerability was. And so they started pushing like crazy to get child labor out of the system. Similarly, when accusations started to surface of widespread sexual abuse in the supply chain, female workers in many apparel factories and male supervisors, very high rates of abuse, they believed and continue to believe that it's super important to get these kinds of practices out of the chain. So that we don't have forced overtime, we don't have child labor, don't have abuse. And what they did is first they tried to do it themselves. And that turned out to be almost impossible. The global supply chain in footwear and apparel is too large, too badly policed. They sent auditors into factories, but the factories were working with multiple buyers. I mean, it was super hard. And so what they did was set up something called the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, where they tried to get the majority of Western buyers of footwear and apparel to uphold the same standards, with the idea that then these factories would be faced, as it were, with a united voice, people saying, no, no, these practices are not okay. And that was moderately successful, but it's very hard to police these kinds of global coalitions, which is one of the reasons that increasingly these kinds of coalitions have turned to partnerships with local government. And so trying to increase local capacity, trying to do what can be done about local corruption, trying in essence to raise the floor in countries like Bangladesh and South Vietnam in ways that will mean that no one is tempted to use child labor or a range of other harmful practices. That's my reading of the history.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the age issue for child labor, because that is the other issue. It wasn't the one that was singled out in the article you quoted, but obviously you talked about it in other places in the book. As Nike's biggest both PR problem for sure, but also disturbing. Now, yeah. So for me, the question is, when Nike did that, responded the way it did through that, all those variety of possible responses, acting on their own, trying to cooperate with local government and so on, did they make the world a better place? And I think that's a tricky question, because there's what was seen, which was the child laborers and making very little money. What was unseen is the growth in wage rates and the reduction in child labor as those countries have grown and gotten more successful. Certainly China's an incredible example of that. The improvements in standard of living, reduction in I don't know this, but I assume in child labor as people become more able to educate their children for longer periods of time. The more disturbing part is that when that practice was stopped of using young workers, and the same would be true of, say, a minimum wage standard, a lot of people who used to work in those factories weren't able to. And the question is, what's their alternative? And that's the thing we don't see. The alternative is going through trash and it's prostitution for young people. It's the tragedy isn't that Nike's a greedy company. The tragedy is that in some of the places that Nike puts factories, the alternatives are tragically horrific. And it's not obvious to me that putting Western standards on those countries where they are in the process makes those children and their families better off. And that's just not seen. It might be wrong, of course, but I don't think we want to over-encourage people to impose their standards on those societies.
I think there are two issues here. One is that there's an important subset of actions which increase economic value. So, and that those are to be encouraged. So I believe that when Unilever attempted to move its entire supply chain in tea to be more sustainable, that increased economic value for everyone up and down the chain. I think the data on that, what I've seen are PhD studies, internal documents, but I think the data suggesting that farming more sustainably increased yields, that enabled higher payments for the workers who were there, that the labeling the tea more sustainably increased brand share, which enabled the firms to pay more for the sustainable tea, that there are an important class of moments or cases when doing the right thing is entirely consistent with generating economic value. And that's important. I argue in my book that those opportunities are sometimes hard to see, that trying to do the right thing provides the kind of vision and courage required to develop these kinds of new business models. Now, you're focusing on a second really important class of changes which are costly and costly to society, difficult trade-offs. And I think what I believe but cannot prove, the data here is tricky, is one of the fastest ways to increase economic well-being is to increase the capacity of the local institutions. That yes, the free market is an unparalleled source of growth and change, but it needs to be paired with good institutions, minimal corruption, a government that can provide public goods for its citizens, the full set of what I would argue are the great institutions of the West. And that the reason the kind of thing that Nike is doing is important is not because in the short term, right here, right now, are we sure this village is better off? Hard trade-off, I would argue sometimes yes, sometimes no, but I'm completely with you. You can't say unilaterally yes. What I think you can say is if firms like Nike become more engaged with increasing the quality of the local institutions, that that's almost certainly a good thing. And so to the degree these consortia really try and bring the whole society to a place of better functioning, that's really worth doing. And that's in essence, when I talk about reimagining capitalism, that's what I have in mind, is firms in service to building the institutions. Now, you could reply, I think, entirely legitimately, I'm not sure I want multinational firms working with local institutions. And here again, I'm with you. I think there's a spectrum. I think this is tricky. But one of the cases I teach is about a massive gold mine in Papua New Guinea. And the case is about, you know, should the firm be trying to train the local police force or provide the money for training the local police force and, you know, doing the education and the healthcare and the school and working with the government? And, you know, there is no government. We're, you know, hundreds of miles down a single road and there's no government. And almost everyone will say in that circumstance, well, maybe the firm should do something. I think that we need to really think carefully about the role of firms in shaping and being shaped by these the institutions that keep the market in check, that keep it in balance.
It's a really interesting question of what role corporations might play in less developed or poorly developed countries with poor institutions. But you and I agree, we certainly don't want them doing that here in the United States. the issue, long-time listeners will know, is what Bruce Yandel calls the bootlegger Baptist problem, invoking yes. something with high ideals that actually serves yourself, right? Higher wages, a large multinational can handle that. The local competition can't. There are a lot of, again, tricky, hidden, not so easily seen consequences of that. So I think that is an issue. You know, one of the things, of course, as you point out, is that often doing good is consistent with profit maximization. And I want to talk about something you discussed in the book related to leadership. You ask, if managing with purpose, which is your ideal of how a corporation should lead and create a culture for its employees and its compensation, if managing with purpose is not only possible but potentially such a powerful source of competitive advantage, then why doesn't everyone manage this way? It's a good rhetorical question. My answer would be that it's really hard to do. Herb Kelleher, when he worked the baggage claim on Thanksgiving and Christmas for Southwest Airlines, created an incredible love among employees for him and respect. Other CEOs didn't copy him because they would have been seen to be not enjoying it. Herb seemed to enjoy doing those things with his employees. And I think that's just a scarce talent. That's one example of that kind of leadership that is so special. But I think it's just really hard to create a corporate culture that motivates people to feel they're on a team, they're working together, and they're going to be treated as teammates rather than as, quote, employees.
I think you're entirely right. And my solution to the problems we face is not that all firms should become purpose-driven firms and treat their employees well and we're done. I really think we need to rebuild the institutions. that the solution to the people who are left behind is through government policy, and we can argue about what kinds of policies. And before we go there, I'm not just massive redistribution. I'm all about increasing education and health and thinking about how we support the free market in places where it's never reached and letting everybody participate. But that my end state is all about a stronger government in partnership with the private sector. I think the purpose-driven firms could be catalysts in helping to get us there. That firms like Southwest Airlines demonstrate that, yes, you can treat people well and you don't have to say, and it hurts economic growth or it makes bad trade-offs. I think what they do is show us a glimpse of what a more just and more effective and productive world might look like. And that's why they're so important. I agree, it's tough. Herb's an exceptional human being, and most of the people I profile in the book are very exceptional people. But I think there's an important middle ground of people who are pretending that they don't want to manage that way because, you know, real people take names and manage by the numbers. And that there are many people who actually could be Herb, who restrain themselves because somehow it's not quite the done thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I want to encourage people like that to go for it, to give it a try.
In the same vein, I can't resist reading the Nordstrom. I can't remember. Is it the Employee Guide?
It's the handbook.
It's one page. I'm going to read it in its entirety. It's quite short. Welcome to Nordstrom. We are glad to have you with our company. Our number one goal is to provide outstanding customer service. Set both your personal and professional goals high. We have great confidence in your ability to achieve them. Nordstrom rules. Rule number one, use good judgment in all situations. There will be no additional rules. That's just fantastic. I just love that.
Oh, and they meant it. And they built a fabulous business on the back of that handbook.
It reminds me of I have one I prefer, which is the Ritz-Carlton motto, which is ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. That's the whole thing. That's their motto. It kind of gives you a vision of what a great employee is and a great employer.
Oh, I love that. I didn't know that.
Well, what's beautiful about it is that if you're in a Ritz-Carlton, it's so fantastic. I don't know if they still do it. I haven't been in a Ritz in a while, but in the past, when I've been in a Ritz-Carlton, because I'm a weirdo, I would ask a employee sometimes, do you happen to know the motto? They do. The other thing that the Ritz does, because they are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen, is that if you ask for directions in a Ritz-Carlton of any employee of any kind, not just the concierge, they will not give you directions. If you say, how do I get to the ballroom? Or where's the restaurant? Or is there a bar on this floor? Or where's the elevator? They will escort you. They will walk with you. And they will – it's a strange feeling. You can say, I got it. No. They will walk beside you because that is their culture. And I think there are obviously times when that's silly and wasteful. But because they enforce that cultural norm, it creates a different feeling of what it's like to work there and be a customer there.
Yeah. So it's super tricky. You know, and often when I'm talking, they're like, well, why don't we just fix all the problems right now? This is really hard. You know, moving in a positive direction is super hard because we have to preserve the kind of raw grit and focus of competition and the kind of change and innovativeness that gives you. But, you know, if that becomes all you have, this takes us back to the epidemic of loneliness and just focusing on me right now. If we cease exploring for, is there a better way? Can we structure things? Can we set the rules so we play a different kind of game? Then we risk really I'm trying to moderate my language, but I'm really concerned about the number of people who can't engage, who are lonely. I see the escalating suicide rates. I am deeply worried about what we're doing to the planet. You know, the dead zones, the declining topsoil. I mean, it's so short-sighted. To me, it's not a conflict with the free market. It's just a matter of sensibly getting the rules right. But that's easy to say and hard to do.
Yeah. Let me raise an issue I don't think it's in the book, which is about corporate structure generally and the very existence of the corporation. So I would make a distinction between privately held firms and publicly held firms. A famous example that occurred at the end of the 20th century, I think it was in 1997, Malden Mills, which was the maker of Polartec, their mill burned down. And the owner of the mill, which was Aaron Feuerstein, it was his mill, his family-held business, decided two things. He would rebuild the mill, and he would pay the employees in the meanwhile, which he did. He was got an enormous amount of loving coverage from the press, and deservedly so, on the surface at least. It's his money. My view was, if he wants to do that, I think that's, you know, that's a wonderful thing. He went bankrupt in 2001, and then I think again in 2007. And part of the reason he went bankrupt is he had lost a cushion, which he could have had when he did this compassionate, wonderful thing. But he made himself vulnerable, which is always, I think, the issue with these take less profit encouragement. When you encourage firms to take less profit, you make them more vulnerable to bankruptcy. You also, I think, risk misallocating capital. But the point is that that's his call. As a publicly held company, I don't think it's his money to do with it as he would like. And there are other ways, of course, to help people who are out of work, both public and private. And I think you have to argue that at the root of the problems that you're disturbed by is this publicly held company, which has offered capital under the investment of stockholders with the understanding that profits will be maximized. If you don't have that, that's fine. But I don't think, how do you still have a publicly held firm? How do you allow for that indulgence, which is not always going to be good, of CEO power over the money that isn't theirs, but rather that of investors?
I don't allow for it. I am not in favor of changing the governance structure of public corporations. It is a betrayal of your fiduciary duty to spend money on projects you know will not return money to the company. I'm a board member of two publicly held companies. I'm completely with you. I'm also the course head for the course we teach on leadership and governance at the business school. And we taught Malden Mills for years for exactly the two teaching points you point out, which is it's his money, but it made him bankrupt. You know, I say to the students all the time, don't crash the company. This is not about some kind of fuzzy, let's forget about the profits and embrace our stakeholders. What I'm talking about is the fact that in the longer term, consistently failing to think about our stakeholders and consistently running down the institutions that surround us, even though they may drive short-term profits, is a mistake, an economic mistake.
So you give the example of Aetna, which raises their minimum salary to $16 an hour. I don't remember what it was at originally, but it was a significant increase. I want to say it was 11, but I can't remember. But they had some floor before this decision, and they decided, for a bunch of reasons, that this was not a good policy. They wanted to raise that lower amount. So they raised it to $16 an hour. So you're arguing that if that led to lower profits, they shouldn't have done it?
Absolutely. Here's where I think the tension is, Russ. I was the Eastman Kodak Professor of Management at MIT for 20 years. For 20 years, I studied large firms that would not respond to major shocks in their environment, even though I think the arguments could be very strong that they should have done, and it would have been better. My first paper that I sent to an economics journal was called Underinvestment and Incompetence in the Face of Radical Change. And the editor wrote back to me, it was the RAND Journal, and he said, Rebecca, you have written a paper about how the moon is made of green cheese, and economists have too little considered the motion of cheesy planetoids. What do you mean, incompetence? But incompetence is real. Failure of vision is real. I believe, continue to believe, that Mark Bertoloni at Aetna made the right decision, that it increased his shareholder value. And why hadn't everyone else seen it? Was there really money on the floor? You bet there was. Because everyone was just operating the standard heuristic. We pay people as little as we can get away with, and that's the way to make maximize profits. Firms, I believe, make mistakes like that all the time, particularly at moments of transition, when the world is really shifting. That was what my research was. I think where we stand now is, I have this hokey phrase, might even be in the book, that it's a Kodak moment, that we can't go on using up the planet's resources as if they're completely free. We can't go on running down government and regulation as if that has no consequence. And we can't go on treating people as things. They will turn around and bite us. Now, you can absolutely hit me on the collective action problem. So what I say to firms is what I say to you. You have to move together. You can't go out and spend all this money and not have a return, but if you move together, you can raise the floor for everyone. We'll all be better off.
But Rebecca,
but I remember, I mean, let me give one more example.
Go ahead.
When Walmart in 2005 announced super aggressive targets for energy reduction, everyone thought it was necessary PR. That Walmart was in such a bad place PR-wise that, okay, they can do these green investments. What they discovered is that they threw money to the bottom line. Redoing the trucking fleet took $1 billion in profit to the bottom line, which even for Walmart was a lot of money. Was that money lying around? It turned out it was. When people started looking, improving energy efficiency gave people 16, 70% rates of return. They just weren't looking. It's a Kodak problem. My book is about the Kodak problem. That's how I think about it. It's not throw economic returns out the window. That's a mistake, a super mistake.
Well, as a passionate defender of free markets, I'm prone to reading the book perhaps a different way than you meant it, right? But I want to go back to the Aetna example. You said if you do it on your own, it's risky, say raising the wages of your workers, and you need to have everyone else go along with you. The problem with that model is we don't know what the right level is. The beauty of markets is it sets that level in a decentralized way. I'm not going to pretend it sets it perfectly. I don't believe the blackboard models of economics and efficiency. There's lots of inefficiency. There's mistakes. There's money laying around. There's entrepreneurial opportunities, of course. I just don't think you want to have a bunch of employers sitting around deciding what that wage should be if, for example, it leads to workers not being able to find work because they're not productive enough. So I think it's complicated. I'll give you another related example and you can react to it. Costco, I think, pays its workers more than Walmart. A lot of people like to point this out and point out that Walmart, therefore, is oppressing its workers or somehow exploiting them. They're different kind of people. They're different kind of tasks in the two firms. I don't think it would be good for Walmart to raise its wages to the level of Costco, but I'm really confident that I don't know. And I'm kind of assuming that Walmart focuses on it. It's true. They could make a mistake. There could be money laying around that they're missing. But I don't think, again, you want to just say, well, look, they underpay their workers. I don't know that they – I assume that they don't actually, despite the that differential between Costco and Walmart workers. So I think there's a danger in being too confident about what works and doesn't work as outside observers.
I am not suggesting to any firm that they unilaterally raise their wages. I am suggesting that for some firms in some times, there are business models which could enable them to pay more. And I think the research we have about Costco versus Walmart is really interesting on this point. Costco runs a completely different work system than Walmart, which enables them to pay more. I wouldn't suggest for a moment that Walmart should unilaterally raise its wages if it didn't have an economic case for doing so and a sense of how to cover those costs. I think the economic case might take 2 or 3 years to play out, because when they did raise their wages, the market punished them hard. They did see the improvements in productivity and engagement that they expected and were able to pay more. But again, this is a time horizon model, not a you should give up on economic value. There is, I think, a broader question, which I suspect is too much for the time we have left or for our conversation now, which is, should society as a whole set guardrails which constrain what firms can do? So firms used to fight back against safety regulations, for example, as being an interference with free market competition. Nobody, I think, would do that now. Nobody, I think, would suggest we would be better off without fundamental safety regulations in factories. I think there are societies where average wages are higher, and those societies seem to be internationally competitive. I think there are ways to build a society where people at the very bottom don't have to be paid so little they have to work two jobs. And their children rely on subsidized food to get adequate nutrition. But that's a systemic question. I am not suggesting that individual firms should like try and get us there themselves if there's no business case. That's crazy. It, you know, the free market will put them out of business. And I realize there are lots of people running around saying firms should do good. It's not helpful. My my colleague Forrest Reinhart used to say they want firms to do all the things they can't get NGOs to do. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about whether we can shift the whole system so that some of these big problems we face can be addressed in a way that doesn't mean sacrificing the power and drive of the free market.
Well, I do think there's a really important issue that you talk about. You describe it as that relates to your point, which is you describe it as self-regulation. I think of it as norms that emerge that are hard to steer. And one could take your book as an attempt to try to change what those norms are in the boardrooms and corner offices of corporate America, and the particularly the time horizon and the environmental consequences of corporate decisions. Certainly, it would be wrong to poison your neighbor's water or air, even if, quote, you could get away with it, even if it was legal. And so, you know, demanding that kind of ethical balance seems to me to be a good idea. I think it's the application in particular areas is where it gets challenging. Let's close with a, and you can respond to that if you want. But let's close with something about the current situation. I like to think of ECOT Talk as timeless. I know that sounds grander than what I mean by it. I mean, it doesn't respond to the news, but there's some issues in the news right now that I think have general applicability. And in particular, the one I'm thinking about lately is medical treatments or vaccines for coronavirus, COVID-19, was in the news in the last few days that remdesivir, a drug that Gilead developed for Ebola, which had no value to them at the time because Ebola disappeared, or it didn't work for Ebola, I think, but they saved it. Yeah, that's what happened. It didn't work so well for Ebola. They saved it. It might have worked with MERS and SARS, which came in the meanwhile, but they didn't last long enough to test it. And now we're in this horrific crisis pandemic where remdesivir has some indication that it shortens hospital stays, which is quite important, actually. It's been underestimated, I think, in the press, as has the potential impact on mortality. This is an aside, the mortality in the study that just came out fell from 12 to 8%, an enormous reduction. But it, quote, wasn't statistically significant, and because it wasn't, a lot of people ignored it. It didn't even mention it in the news stories. It was significant at the 94% level, not the 95. You know, that's like saying if you're 59, you don't have to worry about COVID because it only gets bad when you're 60. It's absurd. It's a misunderstanding, I think, of what statistical significance is and how we communicate the media. But let's suppose it turns out to be, and it may turn out that that study was flawed for 100 reasons and isn't replicated and whatever. But Gilead decided to, until June 1st at least, to give away their stockpile of 1.5 million doses, which of course is applauded and lauded. So I want your reaction to that and whether a pharmaceutical company that develops a vaccine going forward, which would have enormous value, should they be allowed to charge for it? Should they give it away? If you were advising the CEO of a company like Gilead, what would you advise? Easy question, Rebecca.
Well, I'm on the board of Amgen, and I think a lot about pharmaceutical pricing. So you're right, this is the hard question, but here's what I would recommend. I would say, of course, charge for the vaccine. That the prospect of being paid is what will generate the kind of effort and energy that you want to get that vaccine. And if I were the president, I would say, I'd be delighted to pay a fair price for the vaccine. And then I would say to the CEO, but be careful how much you charge. That there is a social norm here. That yes, you want to charge, but if you put it too high, you risk undermining the public willingness to tolerate paying. So I think this is an economic decision. I think deciding to give away the doses was a smart strategic choice. I think it was also ethically correct. That the fact that they had the drug and that they had the stockpile would have made charging a very high price very tricky politically and socially. But I don't think firms should work for the public for free. No, I don't think that. I think it's all about the balance. It's all about a decent return on the energy and focus and attention that you put in to develop that vaccine, but not a completely bizarre hold everyone else to random ransom while people die price. And, you know, how do we think about setting that price? That's super hard. In Europe, they have ethics boards and medical boards that think about that. Is that an ideal solution? No. Is a complete free-for-all that we have here now, given the structure of our healthcare system, I think that's creating all kinds of problems. So for me, it's all a matter of balance. But I'm certainly not going to hold up a flag and say pharmaceutical firms should give away their discoveries. That would be a mistake.
So let me close with a related problem to that and then get your reaction. I've argued on this program that the problem we have with pharmaceuticals today is that Medicare is not allowed to negotiate price. The elderly consume an enormous portion of the pharmaceutical products of the American and international pharmaceutical system. The pricing of those is a terrible free rider problem where the current system allows pharmaceutical companies to reach into my pocket as a taxpayer. And there's no skin in the game for consumers. There's most consumers. There's taxpayers don't observe what's going on. And so a company starts with a drug. It may be a wonderful drug. Most of them, many of them are not. They have marginal impacts on survival. A couple months sometimes get approved by the FDA, get therefore the opportunity to charge large prices from Medicare and health insurance follows along. And so this drug comes out, it's $100,000. So the next year, for a year's supply, say, of treatment, the next year they decide, oh, let's raise it. And you think about what's the rationale for raising it any amount? Is 10%, 20%, 30%? There's no market there. It's a bizarre system, and often generic competitors have been regulated out of business through the kind of crony capitalism we were talking about earlier, legislation that protects existing firms from those generic competitors. The medical profession is compromised in how they interact with that system. As we talked in a recent episode with Vinay Prasad on his book, Malignant. And so each firm has to make its own decision, but you know they're each imposing costs on each other. They're destroying and eroding the trust, I think, that people have because of their ability to abuse the system. And it's going to be very hard for, I think, most pharmaceutical companies to avoid that temptation. And I think it's not going to last forever. I think that's going to end. I'm curious what you think of that.
I think what you've described is a microcosm of the broader problem, that we have neither a free market nor a functioning government in the case of pharmaceutical pricing. And so we're getting the worst of both worlds. And so what we need to do is to rediscover that balance between a free market and appropriate regulations so that we don't lose, so that the free market doesn't run amok. I don't think the current healthcare system can survive in its current form. I worry about our broader system. I think we are losing the competitiveness and the drive and the ability to have really democratically responsible government. And the risk is we're going to end up at the worst place, which is, as you say, crony capitalism. I call it extraction. A few rich people collect the money and the power and they keep it for themselves. And it is not fun.
My guest today has been Rebecca Henderson. Her book is Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire. Rebecca, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Russ, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.